KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in the hour ahead, in his new book, Saving Capitalism, former Clinton administration Labor Secretary Robert Reich lays out the many ways he thinks the free market has failed and failed America, including creating a working poor and a non-working rich. The solution, he suggests, is to reframe economic policy so that it looks more after the interests of the individual than those of the corporation. And he'll join us for the hour next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Former Secretary of Labor during the Clinton administration, Robert Reich, joins us here in studio for this Forum hour to discuss his most recent book, Saving Capitalism, For the Many, Not the Few. Presently professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley, and also the star of a film that was made called Inequality for All. We welcome him back to the Forum program. And, Your Highness, it's good to have you back here.
Good to be here, Michael. You can call me Bob or Your Excellency.
I say, well, Your Excellency is perhaps even preferable where many are concerned. But many might say, Saving Capitalism, Robert Reich? You the savior of capitalism?
Well, the way we're going with capitalism, it's not sustainable. With almost all of the gains of the recovery going to a very small number at the top, most people in this country feeling that the recovery has not affected them. The median wage over the last 30 years adjusted for inflation going nowhere, and poverty still being stubbornly high. I mean, almost one out of five of America's children is in poverty. Well, that's not sustainable, Michael. It's the direction we're going in cannot maintain itself in terms of its legitimacy, in terms of trust in the system, in terms of even the economy itself. You can't have an economy in which there's not enough purchasing power in the middle class and the poor to sustain that economy. And so I predicted in the book that there would be a kind of populist anti-establishment upsurge. I didn't predict how quickly it would happen just a few months after I actually published the book. But undoubtedly, in their own very different ways, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, and I hate to use the two of them in the same sentence because they are so different, but they are similar in the sense that they represent a rejection of the status quo, a channeling of the anger and frustration that millions of Americans have. Bernie Sanders is in a very positive direction, I believe. Donald Trump in a terribly divisive and hateful.
Well, let me jump right on that because although I want to talk about the book and some of the actually solutions you put forward and some of the things you diagnose, particularly about the market and about corporations and about the role of the very rich as opposed to the increasing number of poor, you actually just posted something on Facebook based on an interview that Stephanopoulos did with Trump. And Trump was talking about a heavy Arab population in New Jersey witnessing, at least in this comment he made to Stephanopoulos, his having seen them cheering when 9/11 happened, which Stephanopoulos pointed out the police said never happened. I mean, there was some cheering going on in the Middle East and in West Bank and Gaza over 9/11, but apparently it never happened in New Jersey. And Trump was insisting that he had seen it. His talk about monitoring mosques and having databases and all the rest of this, you've said boycott him.
Well, I think that he needs to be confronted by all Americans, American leaders particularly, need to condemn the kind of racism, hatefulness, and bigotry that now the leading Republican candidate for president of the United States, for the nomination for president, is perpetrating on America. And I also think we should be boycotting every product, every service associated with his name. There's no place in the United States for this kind of scapegoating and hate mongering and lying. It's too close to what we saw in Germany in the late 30s. It's too close to Nazi Germany. I mean, just a few days ago, Donald Trump was suggesting that that Muslims in America submit to a registry, that they actually wear identification symbols. Now, he's retracted, or he's come back a little bit from that in the face of huge criticism. But the fact that we've got to a point in the United States where not just any crackpot, but the leading Republican candidate for president of the United States is saying these things is deeply disturbing. And it also, I think, is a reflection in a perverted way of what's happening in the country. The degree of anger, frustration, deep anxiety that people feel, not only about terrorism, but about the economy, about politics, about the entire system going off track.
Isn't this what you call circus politics, though, too, in your blog?
Yes, it's circus politics in the sense that what Trump is doing is playing for ratings, playing for an audience. Some have analogized his campaign to a reality TV show. I don't think that's a proper analogy, Michael. I did initially, but it's gone beyond entertainment. I mean, he is now really using the anger and frustration that is out there in the public and wielding it as a vehicle of hate and bigotry. He's targeting groups in ways that demagogues have done throughout history.
And the populism behind this that you alluded to before, I mean, you write in your book about four periods, the 1830s, 1901 to 1916, the 1930s and the 1960s. It's almost as if when you're looking at these two popular candidates, one on the left, Bernie Sanders, and one on the right, Donald Trump, the country is in a kind of quandary about where to go, whether the country's going to move to the left or move to the right. But it's always been, frankly, an observation of mine, for what it's worth, that the country does move right when people feel insecure and threatened.
Undoubtedly. And yet, in these four periods, the 1830s, 1901 to 1916, the progressive period, the 1930s, and also to some extent 1960s, and many of your listeners remember, as I do vividly, what happened in the 60s, when we get off track, we do have a tendency in this country to put ideology aside and to roll up our sleeves collectively and get on with what has to be done. We don't succumb to fascism, to the kind of authoritarian populism that other countries have succumbed to, Franco, Mussolini, Hitler. We've had that tradition of right-wing populism. I mean, Father Charles Coughlin in the 1930s, right-wing radio Nazi, effectively a Nazi sympathizer. We've had Joe McCarthy in the 1950s using hate and fear irresponsibly to build up his own power. But we have a tendency in this country to stop that. We don't believe in it. We feel that it is un-American.
Well, there's that history of demagoguery, as you say, and there's some of it, of course, on right-wing radio now. But I want to take you back to your book because...
yes, do.
Well, there's a lot in there about things that we face now.
But it's related, Mike. I think the point I
the economics and the politics, that's
yes,
where I was going to go.
Yes, absolutely. They're interrelated. As I said in the book, politics in the future is going to be less about Republican versus Democrat than about establishment versus anti-establishment. And there really are two currents of anti-establishment politics, these two currents of right-wing and left-wing populism.
Well, we're already there, but let's talk about what you're proposing here, what you're identifying. I mean, The numbers are always worth considering. Over half government people, half of the people now on some kind of government assistance, about over two-thirds going paycheck to paycheck, more working poor, more disappearing middle class. I mean, the whole picture composite is one that not only can really get us downbeat, but also suggests a necessity for some kind of change. And just this kind of maybe populist force that you're talking about, we had a whole program, in fact, on the part-time economy and, you know, the fact that people are now becoming more and more dispensable in terms of, well, disability, unionization, in decline, as you write about in your book and so forth. So right to the heart of it, the rich do get richer. I mean, there is this dynastic class that you write about and dynastic wealth, the non-working rich, I think, is what you call them. So they need to be taxed more, so the argument goes, right? And there has to be more equity because they're taxed more. And yet the Republicans, you say it's not Republican-Democrat, it's establishment, non-establishment. The Republicans have become more and more opposed to any kind of tax raise whatsoever.
Well, the Republicans are becoming fanatical, essentially, about all of these dimensions that used to be quite centrist. You know, I grew up in the 1950s, 1960s. The issues that we're dealing with, investing in education, investing in infrastructure, taxing the wealthy to do so, developing a kind of a culture and a society in which the circle of prosperity kept on widening. Well, those were assumptions that we all shared, not everybody, but were dominant.
Majority, yeah.
But what I try to do in the book, Michael, is really bust three mythologies that are stopping us from having the discussion we need to have. They're mythologies that have been, in some sense, perpetrated by the right, and they're very damaging.
One is the Horatio Alger myth, yeah?
Well,
I would call the Horatio Alger
myth. Yeah, well, the first big mythology is that there is something called the free market, separate and distinct from government. And you have to choose between the two, that the biggest issue is the choice. And that's not true. You can't have a market without government. And government is setting the rules. The issue is not the size of government. The issue is not government's role. The issue really is who government is for. And what we've seen over the last 30 years, as income and wealth have gone to the top, more and more power has also gone to the top to set the rules of the market and tilt it in the direction.
Market's rigged, you're saying.
Well, it is rigged, and it is rigged in a way that harms average working people. That's why Americans are paying more for pharmaceuticals than the citizens of every other country, why we're paying more for internet service than anybody else, why we are paying more for – in fact, just yesterday somebody asked me, why is it that airline ticket prices haven't declined even though airlines' biggest cost, which is fuel, has dropped through the cellar? Well, it's the same. That is that you've got a collusion among the four major airlines. You used to have 15 major airlines. But they have a great deal of power to stop antitrust authorities, to stop government from in turn using public authority to get the airline industry or internet service or pharmaceuticals or whatever, wherever you're looking, back into a kind of organization that works for most people.
So is the myth of the free market also aligned with, in your judgment, the myth that we often hear perhaps more from the GOP, no doubt more from the GOP, that the problem is government? We have too much of it. It's too bureaucratic. It's too incompetent.
Well, again, that's the heart of the Republican mythology. And in fact, not only is government needed to set the rules of the game, you can't have a market without government, but also if you look closely, you find that what we now have is a government that's working in very large measure for the rich. Not just the Wall Street bailout, but the subsidies for big agriculture and
then why would we trust government to regulate more or to have more of a role, especially since they've failed?
Well, the issue again, you know, is who is calling the shots. This is why the book, my book, focuses on reestablishing countervailing power. This is all about power, Michael. We can't have, you know, it's not, again, the size of the government. It's who's government for.
We're back to John Kenneth Galbraith, aren't
exactly.
we?
Exactly. And I dedicated my book to John Kenneth Galbraith. He was my mentor.
Countervailing capitalism, countervailing
feet,
power.
7 inches tall. He was much too tall for his own good. but what he said in 1952 in his book great book, American Capitalism, the concept of countervailing power, was it the thing that was making American capitalism and the American society work fairly well in the 50s? And then subsequently, although he couldn't foresee it, it worked well in the 60s in terms of widening this circle of economic prosperity and creating more avenues of upward mobility for the poor, was the fact that the big corporations and the big banks and the wealthy individuals, their power was countervailed, was balanced by the power of unions, by small businesses, by local banks and regional banks and state banks, by agricultural cooperatives. And what has happened over the last 30 years is not only that the rich and the big corporations and the biggest banks have become more dominant and more powerful, but also that these sources of countervailing power have all withered, have all declined. I think we have to focus on how to reestablish countervailing power. It may not be exactly the same forms. I think that, you know, the union movement is going to and must be reestablished, be re-enlarged, become something that is something like what it was before, but it may be not the same thing. It may be not the same old form of unionization. I was in Missouri on this book tour, and I happened to come across a very large group of small farmers who were organizing. They called themselves conservative Republicans, by the way. But they were organizing against big agribusiness, the big factory farms, the big food processors who had monopolized so much of agriculture, who were taking almost all of the gains with regard to price supports and all the other government largesse. And they were organizing in order to get agriculture back to the family farm. And they felt that these big agribusinesses were hurting them, hurting consumers, and hurting the environment. I kept on running into that, Michael, across so-called red state America, groups of even small bankers that were saying, look at Wall Street, the five biggest banks on Wall Street now have 45% of all banking assets. This is not healthy for the financial sector. We've got to organize and get it back to what it – a kind of balance that we had before. Across red America, they are talking about countervailing power, the same thing that I think we – all of us ought to be talking about. They call themselves, most of them, conservative Republicans. It doesn't matter what you call yourself. Many people were decrying what they said over and over again was crony capitalism. They said, we need to get big money out of politics. We have to stop this kind of socialism of the rich.
Are they aware of Citizens United?
Didn't like Citizens United. They thought it was a terrible – these were people in Kansas City, in St. Louis, in Cincinnati, in Raleigh, who told me they were conservative Republicans. Now, they could have been making that up, but there's no reason to. Many of them called themselves Tea Partiers. They said the system is rigged against average working people. So where I end up in the book is really where I am now after much of that book tour in Red America, optimistic in the sense that you have people joining together. They are Republicans. They don't know that they are joining together with Democrats. In fact, the join has not happened yet. But there is an upsurge of populist, hopefully constructive anger against the dominant rule of big corporations, Wall Street, and the very wealthy.
Yeah, there's an interesting article in the Times this weekend, Who Turned My Red State Blue, which is sort of what you're talking about. Talk about the difference, though, between shareholder capitalism and stakeholder capitalism, because that's a fundamental sort of place that you come to, too.
We used to have stakeholder capitalism after the Second World War for about three decades in the sense that CEOs understood that they had responsibilities to all of their stakeholders, not just their shareholders, but also their employees and their communities. And they not only talked like this, but they actually acted like this. Eastman Kodak in Rochester, for example, General Electric in Schenectady, New York, all over America, you had companies that felt they had responsibilities to their communities and to their workers. Now, it helped that 35% of workers in the private sector were organized into trade unions, so that big corporations had to respect that part of their stakeholders.
And CEOs did not have these extraordinary salaries.
No, they had in the 1950s, early 1960s, the average CEO of a big company was earning 20 times the average worker's salary. Today, it's 300 times. And in the 1980s, one of the big changes and important changes we don't talk about or focus on enough is the movement, the shift from stakeholder to shareholder capitalism. It was brought about largely because of unfriendly takeovers, junk bond, financed debt instruments that allowed these raiders, corporate raiders, to basically justify taking over companies or threaten to take over companies unless shareholder value was maximized. And right on their heels came a new generation of CEOs who pledged to do nothing but maximize shareholder value, even if that meant subordinating the other stakeholders. In fact, squeezing payrolls, making corporations leave their communities. People like Jack Welch of GE, who is celebrated around America, certainly in the pages of the business press, but who laid off a third of his employees. You had others who...
Carly Fiorina.
Well, that's right, Carly Fiorina. But Jack Welch was called a Neutron Jack in an admiring way because he got rid of so many. He just blew the place up, got rid of so many employees. And that was the beginning of a different era for the American corporation and I think also for the American economy.
You've singled out Volkswagen as being far more receptive to workers' rights, but then that scandal hit. You know, it kind of did it set you back in terms of your admiration for them?
Well, I never admired them on any ground other than workers' rights. I think they still have in Germany and also in Chattanooga, where they had that controversy over unionization, and Volkswagen said we actually want a union here. I think on workers' rights, they have been very responsible. I can't, you know, big corporations that are kind of pressured by the financial sector to minimize costs are going to unfortunately do things, and this is by way of explanation, not justification, like Volkswagen did. I think it's completely and totally unjustified, obviously, and they ought to be penalized, and also the executives who did it. What we have a habit in this country, whether it's Volkswagen or one of the big banks or General Motors and their ignition problem, we have a habit of penalizing companies. But it's not companies that do these things. It's individual executives that either turn a blind eye or allow these things to happen by tacitly signaling to their top middle-level executives that they want them to.
Our guest is Robert Reich. Let me bring you, our listeners, into this discussion. In fact, you can join us now with any thoughts you might have or want to share, any questions or comments. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls and your involvement, so feel free to join us again. That number is 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. His new book, Robert Reich, is Saving Capitalism for the Many, Not the Few. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Robert Reich, who is professor at the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley and former Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton, and author of a new book called Saving Capitalism for the Many, Not the Few. And in the new book, essentially, he lays out many ways that he thinks the free market has failed America, including creating a working poor and a non-working rich. And the solution, he seems to suggest, is to reframe economic policy so that it looks more after the interests of the individual than those of the corporations. Here's a Facebook comment from Mike, which goes to the heart. Bob Reich, Mike writes, lots of people like Robert Reich have some pretty reasonable ideas about what an economy that works for everyone looks like. I would love to live in such a place. What I wonder about, though, is how do we get from here to there? Are the moneyed interests going to just give up their power? Not likely. So even if we could start moving toward a more just and functional economy, how would we get there? Would it be a gradual shift or would the streets run red, French Revolution style? I'd like to see the gradual shift scenario, but I just don't see how it would happen.
Well, Mike, it's already beginning to happen. I think one of the important legacies of the Occupy movement from a few years ago was putting inequality smack dab in the middle of the political debate. And one of the great contributions of Bernie Sanders' candidacy is to begin the real political organizing, the political organizing work of a reformist populism. These things take time. They don't happen in one election cycle. But the trend is, I think, clearly there. The fight for 15, the minimum wage victories in Seattle and San Francisco, Los Angeles, and for fast food workers in New York State is another illustration of how when people join together, when there is enough of a movement, we can actually create countervailing power.
But you know the arguments against minimum wage. I'd like to hear what you have to say about them. You have, and you've said if we don't want a constant class of impoverished people, we need a $15 an hour minimum wage, which Secretary Clinton has not gone up to yet. But the arguments, the standard arguments are this is going to lose jobs in the small businesses. They won't be able to pay. And it's going to bring prices up for consumers for different goods.
Well, back in 1996, when I went to Bill Clinton, who was then president, I was Secretary of Labor, and said, you know, we ought to raise the minimum wage. He thought it was a good idea. He said he asked me to go to Dick Morris. Remember Dick Morris?
I'd rather not. But
I would rather not either. But Dick Morris was the pollster.
Think of toes when I think of Dick Morris.
Don't go there.
No, I'm not.
And Dick Morris did. He said, do a poll. And I asked Dick Morris to do a poll, and he came back the next morning. To this day, I don't know how Dick Morris did his polls as quickly as he did. I think he pulled his family. But Dick Morris said 85% of Americans wanted an increase in the minimum wage. Now, Republicans immediately cried, no, can't do that. It will lose jobs. It's a job destroyer. But we went ahead. And even a Republican Congress, both houses were then Republican, finally went along with the increase in the minimum wage. It turned out, Michael, that in the next 4 years, we had the largest net job increase in American history, 22 million net new jobs. I'm not suggesting, obviously, that the minimum wage created jobs, but I'm just suggesting that when you increase the minimum wage, you don't destroy jobs. You actually put more money into people's pockets who are going to spend that money often, in fact, in most cases, locally. That has a multiplier effect in the economy in terms of other employers creating more jobs because they're more customers. Economists have found that employers get more reliable and more loyal employees. They save money. There's less turnover because of an increase in the minimum wage. The real question is, how high can you raise the minimum wage? And the debate these days is between something in the order of $10 or $10.60, which the president originally proposed, and what some of us are arguing, and that is $15. I think a strong case can be made for $15, and the following is the essence of the case, not just an economic case.
What about the standard argument, the case that's made by Republicans that you want to create jobs? Tax cuts. That's the key.
Well, we know that tax cuts have not created jobs. I mean, supply-side economics has tried for years. I mean, it's one of those strange economic doctrines that even in the face of facts and results to the contrary, it continues to live on. Nothing trickles down. You give tax cuts to the rich and you actually don't create more jobs. You don't get better jobs. The median wage, as I said before, has been stuck almost without any increase over the past 35 years in the wake of Ronald Reagan's major tax cuts on the rich. George W. Bush's supplemental tax cuts for the wealthy didn't create more jobs. You create more jobs when you have adequate demand, adequate aggregate demand. You get that when you have a large and growing middle class and you have the poor able to ascend into that middle class. So I view this, Michael, not just as an economic issue. It's also a moral issue. We should not have a group called the working poor. We shouldn't have people in this country who are working full-time, in many cases many more hours than 40 hours a week, and still are poor. That is, to my way of thinking, an economy that's not functioning.
We're talking with Robert Reich, and his latest book is called Saving Capitalism for the Many, Not the Few. We'll go to your calls here forthwith. I just wanted to read, you're mentioning Bernie Sanders. A listener says, it seems that if we want to save capitalism, we have to outmaneuver the big money special interest, bankrolling the politicians. The only presidential candidate genuinely harnessing the power of the people is Bernie Sanders. Another listener says that maybe we shouldn't be picking on Trump when there is major problem in terms of the support from, let's say, Fox News and others who may be on the same page as Trump. But here's Timothy on our Facebook page who says, isn't our ex-Labor Secretary at least backtracking from his support of NAFTA back in the 1990s? The TPP just passed. When will it end?
Well, I'm very much against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and I've been very vocal about that. Inside the administration, I couldn't talk about it at the time, but I pushed very hard against NAFTA, and then when it looked like NAFTA was going through, for the strongest labor and environmental protections I could. When you are in an administration, it's very difficult to speak out, obviously. You have to make a choice. It's a tough choice. And on a number of occasions, including welfare reform, so-called reform in 1996, which I thought was a devastating and fundamentally wrong decision on the part of the president, I talked internally. I argued against it internally, but not externally. One always has the choice to leave office.
You're suggesting it would have been punitive from Clinton if you had spoken externally?
I mean, you cannot keep your office if you're a cabinet secretary and speak out against your boss. I mean, you can resign in protest. And after the welfare reform bill went through, after Bill Clinton signed it in 1996, I seriously considered doing that. I thought it was a devastating
bill. Well, Edelman did resign because of that. Edelman resigned.
Peter Edelman did. He was not a cabinet secretary. Sub-cabinet secretaries, sub-cabinet undersecretaries and assistant secretaries did resign.
What about the administration saying that they have strong enforceable labor and environmental standards in the TPP rather than NAFTA?
They are stronger slightly in TPP, but they're not enforceable. The idea of enforceable labor standards in other countries is a joke. The United States cannot force another country to enforce its laws. In the TPP, we do get an agreement from other nations to establish their own minimum wages. But as we know in this country, a lot of minimum wage laws, the minimum wage laws are not fully enforced. The Labor Department, state labor boards are understaffed, and there is no way of ensuring that any other country is going to enforce their labor laws.
Going to go to the calls quickly, though. A listener wants to know, what does your guest think about the fact that the United States of America is $80 trillion in debt? Who's going to pay it off? And these are the only non-contingent debts. If you add contingent debts, total balloons to $200 trillion.
Well, the issue is not debt in the abstract or even in terms of the numbers. The issue is debt as a proportion of the GDP, of the entire economy. If that ratio is going down as it is, then that debt is manageable. The other question is, what's the debt being spent on? If it's being spent on, if it's being frittered away on issues or on items that really are not necessary, that's one thing. But if that debt, if we're borrowing in order to invest in our future productivity, education, job training, infrastructure, basic research, that kind of indebtedness is responsible. That builds the economy of the future.
And we'll go to your calls. Let me begin with Charles up in Napa. Charles, join us. Hi.
Hello, Professors Krasny and Reich. This may be a bit of an academic question, but if we were to revert to the 1955 federal tax rates, how many years would it take to get the federal debt, Social Security, Medicare, pensions to sustainable and easily manageable levels?
Well, Charles, if you're saying going back to the highest marginal tax rate,
Sanders keeps saying Eisenhower had,
which was, well, that was 91%.
Yeah.
That was a marginal tax rate. That's on the highest incomes. And that would go some way to making us more solvent. But I don't think, frankly, the Social Security Trust Fund is a big problem. All you have to do is take the cap off of the income subjected to the Social Security tax, which I think now is about $118,000. Above $118,000, you don't pay any Social Security payroll tax. If you took that cap off, Social Security would be in fine shape for anybody who is now alive. Medicare is the big problem, but I think there the issue is to go in the direction of Medicare for All, a single payer system. And I don't know why Hillary Clinton says that she's opposed or that would be too expensive. It would not be too expensive. It actually would save the United States a huge amount of money. Most other countries do have a single-payer system. It means that you're not paying private for-profit insurers to market and promote their services. You're not paying for executive salaries that are through the roof. Right now, the major private for-profit insurers are in the process of merging. That's going to cause even higher.
But single payer went down for defeat, Bob, in California. I mean, it doesn't. I mean, this is a fairly liberal state where you would think it would maybe go through, have gone through.
Does that mean we not? We
no, no, no. I'm just saying when you're talking about populist reformation here and all that.
I don't care. I mean, I mean, if things go down to defeat, it takes years to make fundamental change. I mean, I was, I can't tell you how many years I was working for family medical leave, which we have now, but we don't even have paid family medical leave. If you say, well, we can't get it because it's gone down to defeat, even in a liberal state like California.
Not what I was saying. I was just saying that one is sobered by that fact. That's all.
Well, you just fight harder.
We'll go to another caller. Barney, join us. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for the program. I just had a question about the impact of both the, I guess, left-wing and right-wing media focusing much more on, say, social issues as to, to the exception of economic issues, and how Mr. Reich might think that could have impacted the coverage of, say, the creeping power of corporations into the public sphere. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the question, though. I would just add, Bob, that it's not only corporations that you see here. It's Wall Street, mean, in the big picture.
It's corporations and Wall Street and some very wealthy individuals, the Koch brothers, for example. Undoubtedly, there has been an attempt to split the majority of Americans whose economic interests are similar and who, if they got together, I think would have a clear electoral majority to get the economy back for themselves, to split them on the basis of ethnicity, race, social issues, cultural issues. And that divide and conquer strategy has paid off. It's done its thing. We see it right now. The hatefulness being spewed, not only by Donald Trump, by other Republican candidates, I think is an example. And yet, the good news here is that look demographically at this country, it is becoming more diverse ethnically, by race. It is women are gaining ground. Young people today are less willing to be split by these kind of social and cultural issues. They're much more liberal on, for example, gay marriage. I think that it is going to be harder for the right to use cultural and social issues to split the rest of America and prevent Americans from coming together over their economic interests in the future.
Since I mentioned Wall Street, Bernie Sanders has been certainly pushing. He doesn't run negative campaigns, but he's been pushing Hillary Clinton on Wall Street, and she seems to be moving at least slightly in the direction that he's in. And yet he's pretty much intimated that she gets a lot of her campaign funding and a lot of the revenue that goes into her campaign from Wall Street and therefore is beholden.
Well, I think that's a problem for her. You know, she ought to be, in my view, coming out very much in favor of the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated investment from commercial banking. And although it would not have stopped and would not have prevented Lehman Brothers and others from going down in 2007, 2008, would have mitigated some of the problems that we have now with too big to fail. I think that politically it would be useful for her to come out in favor of resurrecting Glass-Steagall. I think also on the merits it should be resurrected. The big banks ought to be broken up, Michael. You know, in before the near meltdown of 2008, the five biggest Wall Street banks had 25% of all banking assets in the United States. Today, they have almost 45% of all banking assets. If they were too big to fail then, they are far too big to fail now. And I think we do have to break them up. Bernie Sanders has been saying this. I think Bernie is exactly right.
And we'll go to more of your calls. Let me bring a caller on. Peter, you're on the air. Welcome, Peter.
Yeah. Hi, Michael. Hi, Bob. Thank you for this wonderful program. I work with Citizens Climate Lobby, Revenue Neutral Carbon Fee and Dividend. I'm going to Paris on Friday. A little nervous, but I'm going to do it, to the UN Climate Summit. I'd like to know your thoughts, Bob, about, first of all, the Exxon revelations, and secondly, how to correct the big market failure in our current system that allows carbon pollution to basically be free.
Peter, I am very much in favor of a carbon fee or a carbon tax and a dividend, putting that really back in the public's hands. The state of Alaska does that, or something very, very similar with regard to oil revenues. There's no reason we can't do that and shouldn't do that. I mean, if you believe, as Republicans say they believe, in taxing things we want less of, then certainly a carbon tax makes a great deal of sense. More power to you.
Good luck, Peter. Bon voyage. Let me bring another caller in from Oakland. Hank, you're on. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I wanted to ask how the homelessness crisis we have now in the United States fits into the current capitalism that we are all under.
Hank, I say in my book that there is nothing intrinsic about capitalism that causes these kinds of crises or lends itself to the rich getting richer and using their political power to become even richer still. We have had these periods of time in American history, very important periods of time, when we have reformed capitalism, made capitalism work for the majority rather than the few. And I think we'll have it again. It's hard to find a country around the world that is not capitalistic. I mean, even so-called communist China is still, in fact, it is evolving toward more and more private property and voluntary exchange of goods. And certainly Northern Europe, the countries that we point to and Bernie Sanders points to as being social democracies, are still fundamentally capitalist. So the question, I think, centrally, is not so much capitalism versus something else. It's how to make capitalism. What form of capitalism do you want? Do you want a capitalism that is working in ways that we feel that it should work for the benefit of most of our population? And that, in turn, I think, depends on keeping big money out of politics, getting big money out of politics. The other hat I wear is a chairman of a group called Common Cause that's been dedicated for 40 years to trying to get big money out of politics, has not quite done it yet. But it seems to me that's the first step. As Louis Brandeis, the great justice of the Supreme Court, said in the first part of the 20th century, we can have great wealth in the hands of a few, or we can have a democracy, but we can't have both. And the first step toward getting our economy back is getting our democracy back.
There again, you've made, by the way, we're talking to Robert Reich, and his new book is Saving Capitalism for the Many, Not the Few, talking about that link between the economy and politics, or politics and the economy. What are your responses to an email from a listener who writes, things won't change unless people vote, but voter turnout in other than presidential elections is abysmal, and there are increasing attempts to suppress voter registration and voter turnout, which the United States Supreme Court has made harder to fight. Gerrymandering has reduced voter choice and made legislatures non-democratic. How do we increase voter registration and voter turnout, and how do we eliminate gerrymandering? Big questions.
Well, California has led the way on eliminating gerrymandering by taking districting out from under the politicians and putting it in an independent commission. Other states can do that. Other states, particularly that have referenda, can do that and are on the way to doing that. What else can we do? Well, Maine and Connecticut and Ohio and a few other states are blazing the trail, leading the way toward public financing of elections, notwithstanding Citizens United. They are doing that. The Justice Department has got to crack down on voter suppression. In Alabama, not only are ID laws now required, but it is very difficult for a lot of people to get IDs, particularly poor people and African Americans, because the motor vehicle bureaus are closing down in exactly those areas of Alabama that are inhabited by poor people and disproportionately by black citizens. So the Justice Department really does have a role here. The Shelby case alluded to is, obviously another terrible Supreme Court case. But it doesn't prohibit the Justice Department from being aggressive with states that are suppressing the law. Let me make one final point here, and that is that it seems to me our greatest opponent, our greatest challenge is not only voter suppression in all the ways we've talked about and not only gerrymandering. Our greatest challenge is cynicism about the system.
Voter apathy.
Well, apathy comes through cynicism. A lot of it is people saying, what difference does it make? Why should I vote? The system is rigged. The political economic system is rigged. That's a self-fulfilling prophecy, because if we say that politics is inherently corrupt, we are essentially turning our backs on democracy. We are letting the moneyed interests have it all. They would love us to become cynical. They want us to become cynical. I wouldn't be surprised if in the secret inner chambers of the Koch brothers' sanctorum, they are talking about a cynicism strategy for America. But we have got to fight cynicism.
You spoke before about the pay increases for pharmaceuticals and internet services, which far exceed really just about any country. I think does far exceed any country in the world. And airline tickets, even though fuel costs have gone down and the dominant price for airlines is fuel. We could also talk about interest on home mortgages, about
food costs. Michael.
And food costs. And here's a listener who says, Stan from Berkeley, why have health care costs risen so dramatically? Can this be separated from the issue of how health care gets paid for?
No. I mean, healthcare costs are going up in part because we have a private for-profit healthcare system. A lot of those costs that are going up now are co-payments and deductibles. They're not premiums. There is actually more federal regulation of premiums, but the federal regulation does not really touch co-payments and deductibles, which are exploding, making healthcare much, much less affordable for people. The point is that all of these pharmaceuticals and internet service and airline tickets and healthcare and interest payments on your debt, as these rise, because there's insufficient competition or because the big corporations have a chokehold on politics, as these rise, you have essentially a redistribution upward from average working people and their paychecks up to the big corporations, their major shareholders, their executives. That redistribution is much larger. That redistribution upward is much larger than any redistribution anybody's talking about downward. We ought to be focusing antitrust laws on busting up not only the big banks but also these other areas of market power. We've got to make sure that even laws like bankruptcy, Michael, bankruptcy laws, you know, Donald Trump declared bankruptcy four times. He preserves his assets. He guards his assets against any creditors. But if you are a student and you have – or a former student, you have a gigantic student loan payment, you cannot use bankruptcy.
Well, you have no bargaining leverage, obviously.
Well, that's – you have no bargaining leverage because you can't use bankruptcy to reorganize your
student
loans.
But Trump can and does and has.
Yes, and if you're a homeowner and you got caught in the downdraft of the Great Recession and you're still underwater paying more than – you know, on your mortgage than your house is worth – you can't use bankruptcy to reorganize. Why is it that bankruptcy laws have been tilted so dramatically in the direction of the rich and powerful and against most other people? It's because the creditors, the creditor organizations, the student loan groups, the big banks, they organize bankruptcy that way. They and their money created a bankruptcy system that is itself tilted in their direction. This, again, is another upward redistribution.
Got seconds left. I'm looking at a listener who wants to know what you think is responsible for the decline of the union movement.
Partly the movement in the 1980s from stakeholder capitalism to shareholder capitalism. But even before that, I think partly Ronald Reagan legitimized. The air traffic controllers had no right to strike. But by firing them, he did say to corporate America, just bust unions. It's perfectly fine to bust unions. Globalization and also technological displacement have weakened the position of a lot of workers. And now we are at a point where many, many people are not only suffering declining wages and working harder, but they're also now suffering insecurity, Michael. They don't know where their next paycheck is going to come from. Two-thirds of Americans living paycheck to paycheck.
Always good to have you. Thank you for being with us. I'm looking at an email from a listener who says, I once sent Obama an email, write to Robert Reich and do whatever he says. I've been in love with him for years and think he should be president for life. We'll end it on that. Good to have you on.
Thank you, Michael.
Again, Robert Reich's latest book is Saving Capitalism for the Many, Not the Few. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Forum's produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Howard Gelman. We also had Danny Bringer as our engineer today. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Senior editor Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.